joining us right now is Harold Meyerson. Harold Meyerson is the editor-at-large at the American Prospect. I called Harold up and I said, okay, Harold, so how do we sort of thread the Sanders-Biden parts of the party? Because more important than anything else is that we have to sort of have a unified front going into the 2020 campaign. I felt somewhat dissatisfied on Sunday night, let me put that mildly, as someone wrote, I think it was, maybe it was at Vox, it was almost like they didn't realize that the last 3 weeks had happened. It was just kind of shocking. So you sent me a really interesting piece from Monday's Washington Post by E.J. Dionne. Sanders and Biden need each other. Here's how they can make peace. So I obviously want not just E.J.'s sort of perspective on this, but the reason I called you is I wanted Harold Meyerson's sort of thoughts on this. This, I guess, was written over the weekend. What I'm trying to figure out is that it's too important for the country for us to figure out not only how the party comes together, Harold, because it's the only way we can role model for how our nation comes together. And if we can't bring the sort of progressive and moderate wings together, oh my God, what do we do going forward? So using sort of EJ's piece as a little bit of a template and a roadmap, and then your thoughts on this, especially after Sunday night, I would love to get some sort of guidance where we all begin to sort of set aside our choices and look to something that really represents more consensus.
Sure. Well, a warning going forward, which is EJ is one of my closest friends, but we do have different perspectives somewhat. I once said EJ is a Christian socialist and hence a gentle soul, and I'm a Jewish socialist, so a little less gentle. But beyond
that, nails it. I know both of you very well. That nails it. Okay, keep going.
Beyond that, I think let me just state one of the problems. And one of the problems is that the Biden constituency and the Bernie constituency are distinct in more than simply ideology or belief. Experientially, there's a real gap, and that's manifested in the age gap in the Democratic Party, which has never been greater. Bernie supporters are disproportionately young. Biden supporters are disproportionately older. And that reflects, in a fundamental way, the different ways those generations have experienced the American economy, which for younger voters hasn't really been all that good throughout the entirety of their lives, whereas older voters can at least remember a time when it worked better. And I think that informs, in the largest sense, the gap you see between Joe Biden supporters and Bernie Sanders supporters. That said, a couple of things. First of all, the Biden campaign understands this gap exists. They don't always, it's not quite clear what they're going to do about it, but they made some interesting moves over the weekend, not during the debate, but before the debate. Before the debate, Biden took a very different position on bankruptcy law, endorsing
right.
proposals from Elizabeth Warren, which would have been anathema to him back when the Bankruptcy Act of 2005, which he was pushing and which Warren was opposed to, went through Congress. And he really moved to much closer to the Warren and Sanders positions on free college, public college tuition. Previously, he had supported, as President Obama had advocated during his presidency, tuition-free two-year community colleges. He changed that, actually, just on the afternoon, Sunday afternoon, right before the debate,
wow.
To their position of, yes, free public college and university for four-year colleges and universities as well. So on the one hand, that's moving somewhat towards the more progressive position. On the second hand, it's not the other hand, it's not opposed to it, it's also acknowledging the specific concerns of younger voters, which is his major weakness. So that's sort of the words. It's not the music, and mm-hmm. both sides need to get the music right as well. And the music is just more receptivity to each other's constituencies, and that's going to require a little less harping on You know, all the dubious votes that Biden took, and in Bernie's case on gun control, that Bernie took over the course of their long careers. I think the major thing for Sanders supporters to realize is that, you know, when you look back at Biden's record, he usually supported what was sort of the conventional wisdom position.
Which of the day, of
is
the
no
day.
And it's no longer the conventional
exactly.
wisdom position, which is why he is changing. And this suggests a course forward for progressives, which is if a Biden is president, you provide the kind of pressure on the from the left that the left usually does. And when it becomes a popular position, he will take it, just as in the two Democratic presidencies that really moved domestic legislation over the past 100 years, that of Franklin Roosevelt and that of Lyndon Johnson. There were major progressive movements leaning on those presidents and on the economy in the case of Roosevelt, on civil rights in the course of Johnson, and presumably on lots of things in the course of the Biden administration. And I think one of the things that's incumbent on Bernie Sanders, assuming he, you know, doesn't get the nomination, which is a reasonable assumption, is to kind of help his supporters understand that they have a role going forward that doesn't require them to abandon their beliefs, and that's what their role is.
So you know,
but isn't, could I just ask, isn't the real question the question of whether we can trust or rely on Biden as president once he's already elected to be receptive to Bernie's supporters when they come to him after he's president and say, look, here's the agenda that we think you need to pursue in this area?
Harold, you just said that. You just said he already showed before the debate that he was opening up to receptivity. He was opening up on the bankruptcy bill. He was opening up on education. So I think what he was showing is there is a door that is open. Look what I'm already prepared to do. I think that isn't a door that he shuts once he gets elected. That would be stupid.
No, but what I'm asking Harold is whether we should trust that Biden is really meaning that he's opening the door, or whether he just is saying what he needs to say in order to get people to vote for him.
Well, I mean, again, I think I wrote something. When did I write it? I think I wrote it yesterday after the debate. That as a leader, Biden is a proven follower, by which I mean when the conventional wisdom shifts.
Yes.
In the Democratic Party, he shifts with it.
Yes.
And that's why he's supporting, you know, I mean, example, you know, the Democrats didn't get a public option in Obamacare in 2009. He's for it now, and he's for expanding it. And it's not Medicare for all, but he's responding to the pressure on the left. You know, and, you know, by the time if he's to become president, it's likely the Democrats will have a narrow majority in the Senate and maintain their majority in the House, and there will be tremendous pressure from progressives in both those houses to push him. I mean, he's not, you know, one thing Biden has never been is a free agent, and no politician is totally a free agent. I mean, even Bernie basically kowtowed to the gun owners in his state once upon
exactly.
a time. And so I think what he's demonstrated throughout his career is he goes where he thinks majority sentiment is. And I think the left has already won majority sentiment on a number of economic issues. And we will, you know, we'll see where that goes.
I love the comment, he's not a leader, he's a great follower.
As a leader, he's a proven follower.
Proven follower, that's, all right,
that's
even
that's
a better headline.
Version of leading.
No.
You know, and that creates
but that's
a real role for the left.
No, but that's it is a real role for the left. And there's a couple of things I keep thinking about as you were saying that. And the idea is he followed what was appropriate at the time, what was the conventional wisdom at the time. And I'm going to use this example with you because it really speaks volumes. My parents were conservative, reactionary, Rush Limbaugh, George Bush, Ronald Reagan Republicans, okay? They were homophobic, English only. I mean, that I came out of that womb, I'll become still shocked by. But let me tell you how things changed. As the idea, for example, of gay marriage became more acceptable and, you know, they were trying to adjust to it, I remember when my dad called me up because I have a daughter who's 38 and for the longest time she wasn't dating and she wasn't seeing anyone. And I think it was really right around the same time as the discussion of gay marriage was finally becoming not only acceptable but part of the conventional conversation. My father calls me up and says, "Is Melissa seeing anyone?" And I said, I don't know, Dad. And he said, "I don't care whether it's a boy or a girl. I just want her to be in love." He couldn't have said that 5 years before. He would have thrown her out the window 5 years before. He would have slammed the door on her 5 years before. My father changed. And he changed because the world around him changed. And because he also knew that the change was not only important for his relationship with his daughter, with his granddaughter, but that it was also important for him. And that idea of that happening to Biden, in a bizarre way, COVID-19 is exposing every weakness that Bernie has been talking about for decades.
Yeah.
And COVID-19, as horrific as it is also for Biden the best opportunity he could ever have, because he will have to follow what is clearly the only answers for what COVID-19 will expose. And the answers aren't less government, and the answers aren't not a more secure healthcare system, not addressing the gap between rich and poor, not laying a foundation for all Americans. In an interesting way, his ability to follow after COVID-19 or as a result of COVID-19 may also provide him with an opportunity to be the most progressive president we've ever had.
Absolutely. I mean, Franklin Roosevelt wasn't a flaming liberal. He was, you know, a middle-of-the-road liberal, but he took office as the economy was in a state of collapse.
Right.
And he essentially said, "We'll experiment, we'll see what works, and if that involves massive expansion of the government, okay, that involves massive expansion of the government." Some of those measures he may have, you know, intended as temporary, certainly the WPA, which employed millions of people who otherwise would not have had work. But by and large, the expansion of government that went through during his presidency became permanent, or at least became right. permanent until the Reagan Republicans began ratcheting it back. So, you know, presidents respond to circumstances. You're absolutely right.
Right.
Harold, can I jump back here and
sure.
bring us back to the issue of trusting Biden in whom he follows, regarding whom he follows? Because I understand that he's a proven follower, and I understand that, as you put it, he's going to follow the conventional wisdom. What I'm not trusting completely, and I'm not a Bernie supporter, I'm certainly not a Bernie bro, and I certainly will not vote for Trump or stay home, but I do have trouble believing, convincing myself to believe, that Joe Biden will actually listen to the Bernie progressives, the AOCs, the Elizabeth Warrens, in terms of policies, or will he go back to the other conventional wisdom, which is the conventional wisdom of the centrist Democratic Party, you know, the Wall Street donors and Tom Perez's and Terry McAuliffe's and people like that, Bill Clinton's, the New Democrats? How do we know which conventional wisdom Joe Biden is going to go back to? And I would feel a lot more comfortable, and I bet you Bernie's supporters would feel a lot more comfortable coming out to be enthusiastic in their support if we had confidence that Joe was going to really listen to the progressives. You said that the progressives have clearly already won, but I'm not convinced that that is. And one statement from Joe saying, okay, I'll go along with you on this, doesn't necessarily mean he's bought it either.
Well, that in part could be a function of which wing dominates the battle of ideas. That would be a function of we certainly need to watch who his appointments are. I think, for instance, if he were to appoint a Wall Street person as Secretary of Treasury, I think there probably would be a number of Democrats in the Senate who would not vote to confirm, which would, you know, compel him to do otherwise. You know, I mean, the guy has some political talent, and he knows that you can't offend a majority of the Democratic Party. And so on some issues, progressives are a majority, and in other issues, they're not. I mean, his reversal on bankruptcy apparently came after a long conversation he had over the last several days with Elizabeth Warren. And I can't, you know, I mean, look, I'm not saying there's a guarantee on any of this. I'm saying that this will be, as all political battles are, contested terrain. And, you know, the left has a role to play in that. You know, if the left doesn't vote for Biden and Trump is elected, the left doesn't have a role to play.
Well, and that's right. That's right. I'd rather run the risk of having a role than running a risk of having no country. I mean, and the reelection of Trump is basically losing my country. And it really is, because he's driving us into the ground, whether it's through the judiciary, whether it's through his incompetence, whether it's through with the kind of, you know, it's just it is. There is no choice. And I guess you have to run the risk with Biden. But I think the other thing that's really important about the Joe Bidens, and let's talk about bankruptcy. I mean, she blames Biden about bankruptcy. Warren wanted that more than anything else, because from her perspective, Biden wrote that bankruptcy bill. You know, a lot of Biden's fingerprints. So for him to basically negotiate with Elizabeth on what for her is very important, but it's one of the reasons why she even entered into this kind of arena, was that she was working on bankruptcy. It is her area of expertise. And what Elizabeth Warren has shown, whether it's with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau or with this concern about bankruptcy, is she understands the vulnerability this has created, and she has addressed it. So I think, in a way, it's not just one item, bankruptcy. Biden has a real relationship with that bill, and Elizabeth Warren truly understands how it is just so unsettling for so many Americans, especially given this fragile economy.
Yeah. You know, one thing that Elizabeth Warren also has said is personnel is policy.
Yes.
And so one of my colleagues at the American Prospect, Bob Putner, actually wrote a piece about a week ago saying, you know, here are some folks who might have positions in the Biden administration that we should be up in arms about. And, you know, I think there's all kinds of indices we can follow and, you know, exert pressure on in terms of that and in terms of policy. But there's no question that that we're in the game. And,
yes.
You know, also, I mean, step back several steps. I mean, it would be much harder for Biden to appoint someone like Timothy Geithner, Obama's Treasury Secretary, to that kind of position. It would, you know, the party has changed. And he knows the party has changed. Does that mean he's going to give the left everything it wants?
No.
Of course not. I think there's, you know, there's a real role going forward for that left. And I think if you look at the polling of Democrats on all kinds of public issues, particularly as regards the economy, but not just the economy, the Democratic base has moved to the left. And it's actually reflected in the platforms of almost all of the Democrats who ran for president. Those platforms were significantly in advance of what was, you know, what Obama pushed and Clinton pushed and Jimmy Carter pushed. The public view of in the Democratic Party on the role of government and things like that changed in reaction to the 2008 crash.
Yes.
And the very unequal recovery that followed from that crash. And I think it's going to change more in light of the COVID-19 crisis.
Absolutely. So we're talking with Harold Meyerson from the American Prospect. So, Harold, I only have a few more minutes left, but what I'm thinking about as I'm listening to you is, didn't he say something on Sunday night, Biden, about the fact that, you know, so many people didn't do perp walks as a result? Was that Biden or was that Bernie? The idea that after the economic meltdown, there wasn't any real accountability.
I think Biden did make a comment.
He did.
And it was while he was, I think, distancing himself just a little from some of the wealth tax stuff. Bernie said, it was the over the vote on the bank bailout, the TARP, and things like
that.
And, you know, Bernie said, you voted for that, and I didn't. And Biden said, well, but look, I do think bankers should have gone to jail.
Yes, he did. Thank God.
He did say that. Yeah.
Yes. Well,
you know,
I
wouldn't put that much stock in the meta significance of that. But it's a reflection of how much public opinion has weighed in and changed on that.
Yes.
And, you know, again, I don't think Biden strays very far from how he interprets what public opinion is.
And I think right now public opinion is going to suddenly embrace the idea that government matters. I think public opinion is going to suddenly embrace the fact that they don't want to connect their health care to a job because they may not have one. I think public opinion is going to suddenly understand the idea of a bailout for them and not a bailout for Wall Street. I mean, is it a bailout? Is it welfare? Is it an investment? I don't give a crap what you call it.
Yeah.
But all of a sudden, and even when he made the suggestion about free college. He didn't say free college a la Bernie. What he said was free college up to $125,000. So I applauded that. All right. And I said, look, that basically represents probably 80 to 85% of the Americans in this country who would get free college. And I'll give it to him. I said, but if he actually did the cost-benefit analysis, it might be cheaper to at least suggest that everyone can go for free college because the cost of actually doing the math. Okay, here's your application. What does your father make? What does your mother make? By the time you actually require people to go through all the financial hoops to show they're making under $125,000, throw in everybody, and it might be cheaper because you know rich people will still go to private colleges. Rich people will still exercise that. So your actual cost savings might be de minimis, in addition to which you'll get universal buy-in. You don't tell, you know, Bill Gates, you can't collect your Social Security check. He gets it too. He doesn't use it, but, you know, he can donate it. But he's in it together. And I think in the end, the fact that he said what he said, by the time you do the math for him, he might move even farther. But I think I will take what he's given and what he said on the record, because I think that is light years from what he suggested and the direction in which it's a tweak to get to the next level.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, since he's taking, I mean, to address some of the things Ken has raised, since he's taking these positions in part because he understands he needs the support of voters that these positions benefit, he's still going to need their support, you know, when he's president.
Right.
Why? He's not going to run again.
The formula for success in politics is you take all of these stands when you're running for office and you abandon them when you're in office. That's not really, what a smart politician does. I mean, there'll be counter pressures on him. I don't think on these policies.
Right.
But again, there'll be also pressures from progressives who are a substantial chunk of the Democratic Party, and a lot of this stuff
and the future of the Democratic
Party is
supported
by people who go way beyond who aren't progressive but still support them.
All right, I need to let you go. I want everyone to go to the American Prospect, prospect.org, read Harold Meyerson's piece, Biden, the Leader as Follower. I love it. Over the past few days, the Democratic frontrunner has begun inching leftward since he realized he needs to in order to beat Trump. And we need you, Harold Meyerson. What a great title. What great content, and thank you for giving us direction. There is a way to thread them together. I am the most hopeful person, and trust me, I've gotten more knuckle sandwiches from the moderates and the conservative Democrats than anyone on the planet. You can see the tire tracks on my back, and if I'm willing to see the possibility, there is a possibility. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Arnie.
All right, stick around, everyone.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1960. That was the day five Italian immigrant workers were killed in Toronto, Ontario, in what is known as the Hogs Hollow Tragedy. Referred to as Sand Hogs, workers sought to connect a pumping station to the water distribution network. They were building a water main in a tunnel under the Don River. The project was already far behind schedule and over budget. Workers were welding in a compression chamber when smoke began to overwhelm the main shaft. Some workers made it out. Firefighters were prevented from releasing water into the tunnel to extinguish the fire over concerns that it would cause a collapse. In addition, there was no backup safety equipment at street level. The tragedy shed light on the appalling wage and working conditions immigrant workers faced just outside the city's borders. The persistent public outcry prompted exposés and investigations that revealed just how bad conditions were. It was truly a tale of two cities. Within the city, union requirements guaranteed breaks and enforcement of safety regulations. But just outside, it was a different story. According to Jamie Bradburn, who wrote for the Toronto Historicist in 2010, workers on suburban projects faced conditions that included lack of proper sanitation, poor safety inspections, illegal withholding of vacation pay, unpaid overtime, checks that often bounced, and groundless threats of deportation. The coroner's inquest determined that callous management, incompetent foremen, inexperienced workers, a disorganized rescue, and inefficiency at the Department of Labor caused the disaster. Though no criminal charges were ultimately laid, the sacrifice of the five men at Hogs Hollow brought about improvements in the conditions that had led to their demise.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Juan Parra grew up in Union City, New Jersey, a working-class, predominantly Latino community. When he was young, he associated environmentalism with faraway problems, like polar bears stranded on ice.
And I never really thought about how it applied to communities that were similar to where I grew up.
But in college, Parra started learning how environmental issues affect low-income communities of color. For example, they often bear the brunt of pollution caused by the burning of fossil fuels. Today, he works for a New York City-based nonprofit called Solar One, helping to implement community solar projects in low-income areas. By subscribing, people can get their electricity from a shared solar project without an upfront investment.
We want to encourage the development and the expansion of community solar because it's a way for so many people to gain access to solar energy, particularly renters, particularly low and moderate income households.
He says expanding access to solar is important, not only for improving air quality, health, and the climate, but because it can save people money. He wants to make sure that as renewable energy grows, its benefits reach the communities, like his hometown, that may need them the most. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
This is Arnie Arneson, and this is part two of The Attitude. As you know, one of the places I go all the time to access great information and interesting voices, especially from professors and PhDs from around the country and sometimes from around the world, is a site called theconversation.com. I think I go there twice a week, if nothing else. And about a week ago, I saw a piece at theconversation.com, and it had a toolbox, okay? And it was kind of empty, that toolbox, except for one thing. And it was sort of referring to what is left in order to address the U.S. economy. And it was entitled, Washington's Recession-Fighting Toolbox is Nearly Empty as U.S. Economy Braces for Possible Coronavirus Outbreak. God, look at how things have changed. Professor Ferguson is joining us, and he is the author of that piece. He is a professor at Grinnell College. He's a professor of economics there as well. His name is William D. Ferguson. He's the author of the book Collective Action and Exchange, a game theoretic approach to contemporary political economy. And I want to welcome him to the program. Thank you so much for joining us, William.
You're very welcome. I'm glad to be here.
It's a pleasure. So you mentioned it was an empty toolbox if we have this sort of COVID crisis. Well, we have it. And we were interviewing a professor from Dartmouth College on Monday. And what he was saying to us was, just in the last 12 hours from Sunday morning to Sunday night, everything had changed dramatically. I don't know what's happening in Iowa, but I know that in the state of New Hampshire, for example, we were informed by our governor that every school was being closed. We were informed every bar and restaurant was being shut down. We saw things happen in a matter of hours that we thought we knew might be happening, but we didn't quite think the immediacy of the moment. So we are in the middle of this crisis. The market has crashed. The Fed supposedly the Fed lowered the interest rate to zero, I believe. And yet I don't think anything feels like it's stabilizing us. So when you looked at our nearly empty toolbox, what do you see going ahead? What are your recommendations from an economic perspective as to what Donald Trump has available to him to do? And what should we expect him to do if we're going to be able to ride this out? Because it'll probably be lasting a couple of months, if not maybe half to three quarters of a year.
Yeah, okay. So first off, we need to think about two basic types of problems. And they're both occurring simultaneously, which makes this situation different from most prior recessions, okay? The first is interruptions on the supply or the production side of the market, and we see this all over the place. The earlier place that I mentioned in my column was China shutting down factories that produce inputs into U.S. production. We can't get them anymore. That's going to slow us down. We're going to have to shut down some production. The more dramatic form that, as you suggest, is going on right now is that in the United States, we are closing things. We're closing restaurants. We're closing, we're closing down many airline flights, and schools are closing and so on and so forth. The impact of that is going to be to cut production in the economy down a lot. So that's one huge type of problem. The second huge type of problem is, and it's very much associated with the first, is a lack of spending. In other words, if people can't work and they can't get their jobs and they get laid off, they're not going to be able to pay their rent. They're not going to be able to go to the local stores and buy things. And that will, in turn, put those businesses in trouble, and you can kind of get a cascade. So what policy has to do is it has to try now to address both sides of the problem.
Wow.
And basically, we have two tools at the federal level for doing it, very broadly speaking. Fiscal policy, which just means spending and tax policy, and monetary policy, which is the Federal Reserve Bank that affects interest rates and a few other things. I'm going to actually start out with fiscal. I want to make some comments on monetary, but I want to start out with fiscal because that's the more difficult one. Let me make one comment about monetary. Monetary can do a certain amount on the demand side, but it has very little ability to do much on the supply side.
Okay. I think you've actually heard them say that, that monetary, one of the Federal Reserve bankers was saying, we can do some things, but what we can't do is we can't make a vaccine. I thought that was
absolutely.
Yeah,
they can't
exactly.
make a vaccine,
yeah.
And they can't really directly put money into people's pockets when people are losing their jobs and not able to spend money. They can shore up the bank system, and that's very important. And they're doing what they can on that, and I'm not criticizing them for that. I think what they did Sunday is appropriate, but it's not everything we need. It's only part of what we need. The other part of what we need comes from fiscal policy. And what the problem on the fiscal side is that we don't there's not enough spending and there's not enough production. And essentially what we need on the fiscal side, I would argue, is something like what we had in the 1930s in the New Deal. We need something equivalent to what was called the WPA, the Works Progress Administration, where the government provided money to put people to work to build things and to get the production back up and get moving. And the WPA built a lot of roads and bridges, and then the Civilian Conservation Corps did all kinds of things in parks, national parks. I mean, some of the stuff they did in the 1930s, we're still benefiting from that. So we need some kind of programs like that to shore up the employment and to pump money into the economy. There, I think, are two levels that we need to deal with here. The first is the immediate, and the second is long-term. In the immediate, they actually are taking some of the right steps. In other words, we need to get tests, COVID tests out to everybody. That's more how do you deal with the coronavirus, not so much how do you deal with recession. But we also need to deal with, as schools are closing, what are people going to do with their kids? Mm-hmm. What's going to happen with childcare? How are they going to go to work if they have to be at home with their kids? We have to figure out some way to handle that. And another thing is we're going to have to make sure that people can get adequate food and adequate housing. There are lots of interesting volunteer community programs springing up everywhere. And that, by the way, is a great thing about America. We have a public spirit where people will help each other out in situations like that. But those kinds of things often need more financing than volunteerism can just provide. Mm-hmm. And so the government's going to have to figure out some way to shore that up. And another thing on the food side is don't cut food stamps anymore. People are going to need them. They need to have them. That funding needs to go up in a crisis like this. So that's one immediate area. Second immediate area is income. People who are getting laid off from their jobs aren't going to have money to spend. What's the government going to do about that? I think at the moment in the drastic situation, I would actually favor some sort of guaranteed minimal income,
right,
temporarily,
too.
On a monthly basis, to put money into people's pockets so that they don't have to be evicted from where they're living, and so that they can help them buy food and things like that. That's expensive. Okay, those are what I would say are the two immediate things.
So
but,
can I just comment on that we've been talking a little bit about the sort of Andrew Yang universal basic income temporarily to respond to this. And so I've been talking a lot about this. And one of the things I said was we have moved to a significant percentage of the population that lives in a gig economy. Gig economy won't be able to get some of the benefits if you put it into sort of the regular employment programs, as if people have a job at a factory or they have a job here. They may have a job, but it doesn't necessarily, you know, go to a particular employer. They may be independent contractors. They may be whatever. And the idea of some kind of a check that comes to every person is something that could actually really reflect the nature of our economy, which is a lot more porous than we've seen historically in the past. So I think that there's value to that. The other thing is, I'm going to be honest with you, because of COVID-19, I'm not going to go out and buy a new refrigerator right now. I'm not going to go out and buy a new car right now. I'm not going out buying nothing. I mean, so in a way, what COVID-19 has said is people need to pay the electric bill. They need to pay the gas bill. They need to pay the rent. They need to pay the mortgage. They need to do those absolute basics, food, shelter, health. But what they don't need to do necessarily is what's not being made anyway. So there's kind of we have a supply chain problem because of China. We have a problem because we're in this sort of, you know, fear of probably a national shutdown, which will happen. But that national shutdown also means people aren't going to be out going to the department stores to buy stuff because, frankly, that's not what they need right now. What they need is sort of the stability to keep a roof over their heads and keep their children safe and prepare for whatever comes forward. That's not going to last a long time. But even in that temporary period of time, I want to know that if I am someone whose business now has seen it tanked, that at least my family can take care of themselves until I'm called back to work, when people actually need what I make or want to shop where I work.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I think people have to deal with the immediate needs. And when they stop buying refrigerators, the refrigerator workers are going to get laid off.
Exactly.
And they're going to stop spending money in stores.
Yeah.
So that's going to compound the entire problem.
Right.
And so what I'm saying is that what they have to do, what the government has to do, and this is difficult now. We're running a $1 trillion deficit.
I know.
Thanks to the recent tax cuts. But we have to spend anyway. We've got to push that deficit up, because if we don't, things are going to get worse. And so we have to give people some income. I would certainly advocate continuing with unemployment insurance, making that easy. We probably some sort of temporary guaranteed income makes sense. Even though the gig economy is larger than it used to be, it's nowhere near a majority of the economy.
Oh, no, no, so of course not. I understand that.
Keep that in mind. But the other thing is that there are many projects that could be done with longer-term benefits that could be used to employ people right now. And that's where the analogy to the work public, the WPA, work public administration comes in hand. In other words, we've got hundreds of infrastructure projects in the United States that could be funded and could be worked on right now, having to do with water treatment, sewage, roads, bridges especially. Everybody's talked about bridges multiple times in the last 10 years. We could be putting more money into various types of research and development, medical in particular.
Yeah.
Let's be ready the next time one of these things comes around.
Right.
We could be putting money into projects that will address the future consequences of climate change. We could put money into promoting more solar, wind, renewable types of energy and creating employment in those areas. We can build jobs there now. Maybe we're not building refrigerators, but we can put jobs into some of these other areas where the public needs this stuff. Or we will need this stuff in the long run. And if we spend money that way on infrastructure, on what you could call, what some economists call government investment, borrowing to invest is a lot different from borrowing to consume.
Oh, yeah, I totally agree. Yes.
Yeah, so if you borrow to invest in things that are going to generate long-run benefit for the population as a control, as a whole, it's very different from running up a debt for a different reason, for, you know, just for the purpose of consumption.
So, Professor Ferguson,
so there are multiple projects we can do
right
along those lines.
I'm always having run for governor and run on things like, you know, redlined bridges and everything else. I totally understand the concept of that investment in infrastructure. Debt for infrastructure versus debt for debt's purposes is a very different thing because you haven't there's nothing to show at the end of it. I keep telling people, you know, when you play at a casino and go into debt, and when you buy a house and go into debt, it's very different debt, you know, and you have to kind of look at it that way.
Yeah.
But my daughter lives in China, and so we've been talking a lot about this because they're ahead of us, and maybe they're coming out the other end if I really do believe what the government says in China. But one of the things that I think is interesting is you weren't working on infrastructure when you're told to social distance. You're not working on infrastructure when you can't get together with groups of more than 5 or 10 or 20. So the infrastructure thing is a solution for the investments that we need to make. But I think what the government is now facing right now is how long this, I think there will be a shutdown. I think the shutdown will happen sooner than most people think. I'm not quite sure how long it will last. But I think that there has got to be some kind of a temporary response to that, then an ability to ramp up as we return to something close to normal. And that isn't a switch. It doesn't happen at the end of 3 weeks. It doesn't happen at the end of the month. So in a lot of ways, the infrastructure piece is a piece maybe even for after the 2020 election, and it's a sound one we've been hearing about. For how many times did Donald Trump roll out infrastructure week and it never happened? We only had deficit month and year and whatever. So I'm trying to figure out what is the immediate response that will get us through this as then we ramp up coming out the other end, because we can't talk infrastructure when people can't commingle and be next to each other.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's exactly what I said. I said there are two categories. There's immediate response, which were the first list, and then I said infrastructure was the long-term response.
Okay, perfect.
That's longer term. It takes a long time to ramp these things up. None of them are going to start next week.
Absolutely. There's no such thing as shovel ready.
You need to shore up spending immediately. You need to deal with the medical problems immediately. There's probably more spending that can be done on medical facilities. And again, you need to figure out how in the world are people going to take care of their kids and go to work.
Yeah.
Maybe not everybody needs to go to work, but some people need to go to work. We have to have people in the food stores.
Yeah.
We have to have people who can drive the trucks that deliver the food.
Exactly.
We have to have the food continue to be produced. There are certain things that absolutely must be produced.
Well, how about people making the tests and transporting the test materials to where people are?
They're essential.
Yeah, you can do that. And so we're going to have to come up with mechanisms for doing that. And, you know, and here we're sort of mixing together virus response and recession response. This is some of both, and a lot of the virus response things that are absolutely necessary are going to be relatively cheap and probably won't do a lot for a long-term recession.
Well,
that's why you need this other piece of the picture. But we got to get through the immediate period before we can go to the long run.
And what's interesting about some of the things that you're talking about is that we're talking with Professor Ferguson from Grinnell College. He's a professor of economics, and that is that as I'm looking at the idea that we need to build more hospitals, or we need to have more beds, or we need to have more respirators, is that what this is also showing us? This isn't just a solution for now. It is a solution for the future. So in a bizarre way, this is both an infrastructure investment that responds to COVID-19, but it's going to be an infrastructure investment that we're going to need going forward. If it turns out that we have a new president, we're probably going to have a pretty expansive public option, which means more people will be able to go to a doctor when they're sick. More people will be able to access the healthcare system. The fact that we spend so much money on healthcare and have so few beds compared to Italy, so few beds compared to most of the European nations, should tell you that there's something wrong here, that more people who are sick are not even able to access a rational healthcare system because they can't afford to do it. Not that they shouldn't be in the hospital. So we can somehow create this false idea that we don't need these beds, when in reality we probably do need these beds. But the way we set up our system of healthcare, we haven't had beds to access, and we haven't had the affordability to be able to access them. So this investment in infrastructure, i.e., in this case, healthcare, is actually not just for the temporary COVID, but it sounds like it also might be useful as a permanent solution for healthcare going forward.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah. Ken.
Any investment in medical equipment, medical R&D, that's all long-term in addition to short-term.
Absolutely. Ken, you want to weigh in?
Yeah, thanks. Professor Ferguson, I just want to ask you, I certainly hear your recommendations, and they sound really excellent to me. What I'm wondering is whether there are other schools of economic thought where they might not prefer your recommendations. And
economists that disagree.
And it might not do as much good. And what risk is there that Joe Biden would appoint one of them? I mean, like, would Geithner, who became Obama's Treasury Secretary, would he be supporting the kind of macro policy that you're talking about? Or do we need somebody who's of one or the other schools of economics, or somebody from the Chicago school that Trump would put in? But in particular, does Biden have to put in somebody from your school of economics? I don't mean Grinnell, but generally, as opposed to the Geithners of the world, the Wall Street bankers and corporatists.
Well, I might not draw that line as sharply as you do, but I mean, I think he needs to appoint someone who's forward looking and willing to spend money on infrastructure and investment.
Is there a name for that?
And there are some divisions there, but there's more than two schools of economics. And there's gradations along each of them. So, there are plenty of people out there who would probably want more of what might be called a free market approach, and that I would tend to disagree with, because I think particularly in a crisis like this, you need to inject a large amount of spending, and there really aren't other agencies that can do that.
A free market assumes the word market. and what we see now as a result of COVID is that that's what's disappeared, is there is no market. So the idea of the free market being able to respond, what we're seeing right now is that if there really is a need for government when you have a pandemic, that there really is a need. I mean, look what the stock market keeps looking for, some sign, And I think, while I'm not going to suggest that the Chicago school will be trashed as a result of COVID-19, I think people are beginning to recognize, just as they did after the 1929 crash, that this is something that requires collective action, that requires government investment, that requires some kind of deficit spending, that requires a total retooling a lot of our economy. We had a previous speaker on, Harold Meyerson from the American Prospect, who said that kind of FDR response actually lasted until Ronald Reagan. Well, that's fine with me. We'll have Joe Biden, and it'll last until I'm dead. So, you know, and we'll let them figure it out in 2090. But I really do think that people are seeing, and I don't care what side of the aisle you're on, even the very, very wealthy, it turns out that they need an investment in this sort of rational economy without the kind of grotesque inequality, because the grotesque inequality is making our response to COVID-19 that much worse.
Yeah, you're not going to get much argument from me on that. I do think that events like this shift thinking.
Yes.
I think the Great Depression shifted economic thinking fundamentally.
Exactly.
And I think this event potentially could do exactly that as well.
So,
I think that's right. You know, from the title of my book, Collective Action and Exchange, I think we absolutely need to think far more thoroughly about when collective action can arise, how it's difficult to get it to arise, how to coordinate it, how to motivate it, and all of that. And essentially, my opinion, that's what policy is all about.
So Ken was asking the question, so who would be someone that would understand the collective action, who would understand the investments, who is someone that would carry some respect in the sense that they're not necessarily sort of tending towards a free market, that would be on a short list for Professor Ferguson to choose? Come on, I know this is hard, but I keep wanting names so I can understand who they are, how they think, what they would anticipate going forward. Or is it that this is a come to Jesus moment for a lot of people, and a lot of people who might be more historically free marketers are suddenly looking at the free market not being the strategy for success? I mean, no one is wedded to anything for life. You know, I love the movie Crash. No one's all good and nobody's all bad. Well, no one is wedded to what they believed 25 years ago, and they suddenly realize that what worked 25 years ago, you know, sucks today and won't be responsive to what are turning out to be very different needs.
Yeah, I didn't come to this prepared with a list of names.
Yeah, that's fine.
I'm sure there are a lot of good people out there, but I haven't given that any thought at all, so I'm hesitant to give you a list of names.
How about other books?
You know,
other books.
there's some good think tanks out there.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
And you know, by and large, and I do agree that I think some people are going to shift their opinions on this. But there are certainly some progressive leaning think tanks that I think have some good people. I'd be interested in their economic staff. I think some of the more centrist think tank, Brookings Institution, they've got some great people, too. I wouldn't rule them out either.
Right.
I would not consider them to be too free market to be useful on this.
Wasn't the economic advisor to Joe Biden Bernstein? I think his name is
yeah, it? Jared Bernstein, yeah.
Yeah, so I've known Jared for a while, he's not this liberal progressive, but knowing Jared Bernstein, is he someone that could give Biden the kind of guidance that you were just describing, that truly is a little more aware of what it is we need to do, and would be one of the people that could more easily push Joe because he's been so close to him for so many years?
I know Jared a little bit, not a lot.
Yeah.
But, yeah, he might be the type of person that could do that, yeah.
Well, but would we need somebody like Austin Goolsbee from the Obama administration, or would we more likely need somebody like Joe Stiglitz?
Goolsbee, I don't, you know, I haven't read into him very deeply. I think somebody like that, though, might in this situation realize we got to move.
Exactly. I think so, too.
I wouldn't put that past him.
Yeah.
Stiglitz, yeah, you know, I like Stiglitz a lot. I think he's a great academic and a great thinker. Is he a great policymaker? I don't know. Those skills don't necessarily always coincide.
You're absolutely right. And the only reason why we asked it is that when we were talking with Meyerson from the American Prospect, he reminded us about what Elizabeth Warren says, that personnel is policy. Mm-hmm. And so one of the reasons why we were kind of pushing you on the name is that it really is important to understand that it's the personnel that sort of tells you what kind of inputs will come in, how what they will look at as they define the policy, what they will bring to the table. You know, the policy just doesn't bubble up. You know, it gets guidance and it gets navigated. And so when you realize that personnel is policy, part of the reason why people keep saying, give me a name, is that really, to me, tells me more about Joe Biden than the Joe Biden of 40 years ago, 30 years ago, or 20 years ago. I want to know about the Joe Biden that might win in November of 2020, and I want to know what the personnel looks like, because I want to know more about him.
That's good, and I do think that is the kind of – that's the way that, let's say, the progressive wing of the party can hopefully influence Biden.
I think so, too. I am so grateful. Thank you for taking the time and agreeing to this at the last minute, Professor Ferguson. I really appreciate it. And I hope you will allow us to call you back in a timely and reasonable fashion. So thank you so
much. Yeah,
absolutely.
No, I enjoyed the conversation. Feel free to call me back. There are lots of things I can talk about.
I would love it. All right. And take care of that little Grinnell College and the economic school from Grinnell. I love it. Mm-hmm. Take care. Ciao. Bye-bye.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right, everyone. And our song that we end with.
I looked all around me, and what do I see? Nothing but troubles and trouble and misery. Things gonna get better, just wait and see. Gotta stay by my side, darling, just you and just me. God's found a love me. I say it's hard to find. One day, darling, you'll have some peace of mind. Things gonna get better. Wait and see. Gotta stay together, darling, just you and just me.
It's all right.